Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and welcoming back from 2017 and also from the fabled land of Oz, it's a very warm return and welcome to Glenn Lees. Good morning, good evening, Glenn.
Good evening from Australia, Eamon. It was actually 2016. I think the episode, yeah, went up in September 2016. So I went back to have a look. I wouldn't have thought it was that long ago. Time goes so quickly.
Yeah, it's been a long while, isn't it? You were here for, as you say, that episode 11, Song of the Surfer, and then episode 48, Fiends of the Eastern Front.
Oh, I forgot about Fiends. Jeez, I should have went back to look at that one. Yeah.
So it's been a while. What have you been up to lately? What have you been reading that's keeping you interested in 2000 AD and other comics?
I've been sort of a bit lackadaisical with the prog. I still subscribe to the prog and get the physical issues, and I'm a bit behind with it, but I sort of try and read a issue or two of that every other week. And yeah, I'm probably like a lot of people, I have a reading pile that sort of outweighs my actual reading sometimes, but I still keep up with the prog. I still keep up with the news of the prog and listen to a few different things and read different things about it. I've been reading lately, new comics wise, the new EC comics from Oni Press, which are sort of like new titles that they've started. They've got Catacomb of Torment and all these sort of a few different horror ones and a science fiction one. So they've got new comic book creators sort of doing stories, and some of them are 2000 AD alumni in there, like PJ Holden and John McRae, and the design work's done by Ryan Hughes, who used to do the design work for 2000 AD. So that's probably the main sort of thing that my new comics are. I still read Savage Dragon when it comes out. I still enjoy it. It's been sort of a bit less published recently because I think he's been working on other things. And then outside of comics, I'm still reading graphic novels and things like that of, you know, whether they're Rebellion sort of things or other sort of things. Like I've sort of accumulated quite a bit of Alan Moore's stuff that I've been sort of working through, haven't looked at it for a while. I just completed getting some to read of The Punisher Max by Garth Ennis, so I've got probably more to read than what I'm actually reading. And then I'm actually also reading at the moment the Seven Penny Nightmare by Steve Holland. It's his book about action, and I'm probably three quarters of the way through it, and it's been interesting. Sort of, he's very thorough with his research on it, and quite interesting. So, other than that, that's probably about it. That's related to the world comics and the world of comics sort of thing. So,
I'm reading The Seven Penny Nightmare as well at the moment by Steve Holland, and it's fascinating stuff. The another account of the history of action. Just wonderful.
There's things that I've read before because, you know, reading Pat Mills' books and some of the interviews that were in the magazine and stuff, which is what he has sourced things from, and he's got a very detailed bibliography if you want to track all these things down. But then there are still new things that you're finding out when you're reading it as well, which is quite interesting. So it's, yeah, very well put together.
Well, we've done Song of the Surfer, we've done Fiends of the Eastern Front, two absolute classics from the early days of 2000 AD. Tell us, what is the book for today's book club that you've chosen?
Harry 20 on the High Rock, another self-contained story that is from early on in the progs, 82, 83, so right in the square in the Golden Age. But interestingly, just, yeah, one of those one-off stories that lasted, I think it was 21 episodes. And then that was it pretty well, and never resurfaced until recently. There was a little little story in the Free Comic Book Day 2015 of 2000 AD where they had a little twist ending, which I guess this is a story for twist endings and twists. So, yeah. But, yeah, one of those stories that I think I come across very early in my comic book reading and I don't know, it just stuck with me. I guess I just liked that sort of Jerry Finley Day sort of story archetype and then, yeah, Alan Davis's art's really nice as well.
Great stuff. So Jerry Finley Day and Alan Davis, lettered by Tony Jacob, editor Steve McManus, but Richard Burton and Robin Smith also had a hand in this. As you say, 20 progs, 287 to 307. I've got the trade collection from 2010, which also has an introduction by Alan Davis. You've got, I think, the Ultimate Collection volume in front of you.
Yeah, correct. So it was one of the latter ones. It's I think it came out as number 168, but it's spine number 160, and it's got an introduction by Matt Smith and a few pages at the end where there's some sort of talking with Robin Smith and Steve McManus as well, sort of with some of their insights into the process. And there's actually also some character concept sketches as well by Greg Watkus, who was the original artist that they had planned to draw the series. So in addition to Alan Davis, it was meant to be, because it was going to be a 20 issue run pretty well straight through 100 pages over 5 months, they didn't know whether an artist would be able to keep the output up, and yeah, so they were getting Alan Davis's cover, and all of a sudden he was the one that was tapped to draw the whole thing.
Amazing.
The other interesting thing with this in the back of the mega collection, they talk about that this story was actually come up with by Jerry Finley Day as a concept and script and sat in Tharg's drawer, Steve McManus's drawer, for a couple of years. I guess they didn't need it immediately, and then when it did resurface, they said that Alan Grant, who was a sub editor at the time, he was given it as a little bit of a polish job, with some of the smooth out the story and the dialogue and stuff. So I think I had heard that in the past, but yeah, it was sort of mentioned in this volume again as well. And I think I've got a few little things that I've read in there, like just some of the things where I can assume it's Alan Grant's humor coming through, because he was always one with John Wagner that had that ability to have those sort of black humor or little punny sort of things that would come into the comic nicely as well.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I did read in Alan Davis's introduction in my volume that another writer had taken a pass at it, but he didn't say who that was. So it was probably Alan Grant.
Yeah. I think he was sub-editor at the time. It was before he went freelance, but I think they actually gave it to him as a freelance thing to do over a weekend, where he gave it a polish, from what it says in this book. And then it also sort of fits in, I know, when Pat Mills has talked about the genius of Jerry Finley Day, he was very good at coming up with concepts, but he could be a bit, he said he'd need to be sub-edited a little bit just to smooth things out. So the comic probably, that was probably why we didn't get as much Jerry Finley Day after a certain point in the comic, because the editors weren't as willing to do that necessarily, instead of taking the gold and giving it a bit of a polish. So, yeah.
And remind me, were you reading this at the time when it came out? When did you first read Harry 20?
No, so this is yeah, it was before I was collecting the prog, and it was also the way I read this for the first time was through Quality Comics Best of 2000 AD, and it was sort of in different chunks, because I was getting back issues, so I actually got I don't know however many, they might have had 15 pages per issue of Best of 2000 AD, because I think it ran over about 7 or 8 issues of it, and I actually got one of the latter sort of sequences with the big spoiler in it, was what I actually read first. And then over time, I I tracked down, I think it was in a best of 2000 AD, the one that was released by IPC, and that's where I got to read it in one big chunk sort of thing. And then, yeah, subsequent to that, I did track down all the progs, like, and so I do have all of those. So, yeah, once again, with these sort of things, it's buy it five times.
Yeah, how many times do we buy all this stuff? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of funny. When I first started collecting comics and I was buying 2000 AD off the newsstand, we had like a little, it was a very rough little, it had a sign saying flea market. It was like an old house with like a book exchange and just sort of a bit of junk sort of stuff underneath it. And so I'd go there every month or so and have a look through comics. And I found it was best of 2000 AD. I think it might have been issue number 13, had Johnny Alpha on the cover. And so I was sort of hoovering up anything I could get 2000 AD related, and that was the issue that I got. And I forget what the story would have been like for Johnny Alpha in there, because they had several different things in there. But Harry 20 was in there, and I remember, yeah, there was a few like there was the sequence with the Squawk, and then the big reveal of our. Yeah, the big twist at near the end of the story, or two thirds away through the story, sort of thing. So yeah, and it definitely I can remember it piquing my interest, going, "Oh wow, that's so cool," sort of thing. So yeah.
Well, you talked about Gerry Finley Day being great at concepts. Just give us the sort of the pitch setup of Harry 20 on the High Rock. Remind us what this story is about.
So Harry 20, his real name's Harry Thompson, and it seems that there's a corrupt governments on Earth, and Harry gets arrested for shipping food to different parts of the Earth, Oceania, where he's not meant to, and he gets taken to court, and he gets sent to the High Rock, which is an orbiting prison satellite, and as part of the punishment, you lose your name. So your name becomes your first name and whatever your sentence is. So he was sentenced 20 years, and Harry 20 gets sent to the High Rock. Now, of course, like all good sort of stories in this vein, Harry's not going to stand for this. And his idea as soon as he gets there is, I'm going to break out. So what we've got is a good old fashioned prison break story. Yeah. I think that's what I sort of liked when I first read it. So yeah. And, yeah, once he gets there, he finds it's not as simple as what he thinks it's going to be.
Indeed, as it never is. And, you know, Gerry Finley, we always say he's great at doing these setups. He's also some pretty memorable characters he's created here. Obviously, yeah. Harry 20 himself, but some of the people he meets on the High Rock are wonderful. Tell us about some of them.
Yeah, so our other main sort of, we've got our protagonist is Harry, and then we've got his cellmates Ben 90, who's rumored to be the first prisoner on the Rock, and then he's got Genghis 18, a Mongolian cellmate as well, and then we've got Warden Worldwise, who seems to be a fairly unscrupulous figure running the High Rock with an iron fist, and he's got some guards that are fairly bad as well that carry out some summary executions and things. Would you say Pusser? Guard Pusser? Or
yeah,
Pusser?
Guard Pusser. Yeah.
I assumed it would be Pusser. And then there's the chief thrower is the other sort of guard. And then outside of that, we've got other prisoners who also become a bit of either a thorn in Harry's side. There's Big Red One, who's this giant Nan who's in for 100 years, and he's got a couple of outsiders, 77 Sunset, which is a Japanese prisoner, and what's the other one? The Route 66. So, it's actually, in some ways, the names are a little bit more more inventive than some of Jerry's other names, where we had, you know, Rogue and Helm and Gunner in Rogue Trooper. but yeah, it is the fact that the High Rock's meant to have 10,000 prisoners and we've only got one Harry 20. I just think Harry's such a common name, and 20 years would have been a fairly common sentence. So I thought we might have had more Harry 20s in there, but yeah. And then I think this is the one that I think is an Alan Grant polished one. Speed 16. He's a guy from Sweden, I assume, and yeah, he's in for 16 years. And then we've also, I don't know who was whether it was an Alan Grant one as well. 21, they don't really know his name, but they call him 21 Toady because he's the guard's trusty and also a bit of a narc, and so they call him 21 Toady because he's a toady, but they also, it's like a pun on 21 today. So yeah. So yeah, he's probably the other main sort of one that one of the prisoners that gets a bit of a run as well.
I would say, I suppose, it was fairly common at the time in 1982 in comics, but if there is one criticism, they do slightly lean into sort of racial stereotypes a bit for some of the other prisoners.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a, like, Genghis 18, the Mongolian who the guards call Slant a couple of times, yeah. And things like that. I guess, yeah, it is definitely of its time. I think it's also, it's almost like a shortcut to, because it's a very, very, you know, like it's 100 pages overall, but they pack a lot in there in those 100 pages. So sometimes I think by having some of those sort of stereotypical sort of things, it's a quick way to, you know, you don't have to explain too much the background of a character or the plot or whatever. It's just a quick way of saying, well, this guy's, you know, he's from this area of the earth. And it seems a lot of the there's some bad guys there, like Big Red One, who's like a really bad murderer, and 77 Sunstrip's like a Japanese, he's like a Japanese gangster, but Genghis is like another sort of political prisoner, a bit like Harry, where his family didn't sell land to the military and he's being punished for that. So we've sort of got, yeah, a mixture of sort of different people in there that have been sort of screwed by the system, I guess. And then once they get there, yeah, the guards are pretty horrendous in their treatment of them, just bashing them just to put them in their place and things like that. So, yeah. But, it is, I think when you read a lot of the stories back then in that sort of era, there was a simplicity to some of the stuff, and you know, it's a bit like some of the dreads back then. They'd literally, I guess they'd think of a gag and then they'd write a story around it sort of thing, just so they could have that punchline. So I sort of think, yeah, in its simplicity, it's just, yeah, a product of its time and things like that.
Well, let's talk about one of the sort of really great features of Harry 20 on the High Rock, which, of course, is the artwork. We've mentioned that Alan Grant probably took another pass at the script for Jerry Finley Day. I was interested to read Alan Davis's introduction that there was another artist, John Watkiss, was originally planned to do Harry 20 and then had other commitments. They were going to get Alan Davis to be his backup artist, and then they eventually asked Alan if he could do the whole thing. What do you make of Alan Davis's artwork throughout Harry 20?
I'm sort of surprised because I didn't realise how early it was in Alan's career, because that was the sort of the reasoning behind having him as the backup to John Watkiss was this is a fairly early project for him. And yeah, but it seems really like he's got a good eye for sort of action and packing little details into things and stuff like that. So yeah, I was kind of surprised when, because that was sort of touched on in this volume as well, where it was sort of he was the backup because he was a new guy to the, I think he'd only done, was it Captain Britain in in England and maybe a couple other things in fanzines with their skin. So, but when I sort of look at it, I just, it's a very solid sort of storytelling. And I know, now that a lot of the characters were designed by John Watkus, but the characters are very distinctive. Like you got no doubt who everyone is and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's great artwork. And there's sort of you can definitely sort of see with some of the art, like when I read his other stuff in like DR and Quinch and stuff, you can see it's the same artist sort of thing with just some of the facial sort of techniques and things that he does. So yeah, no, I think it's really good art. The interesting thing I about John Watkus was he was going to be the senior artist, and then I think they said he got an offer too good to refuse with one of the advertising agencies, so that's why he suddenly said, look, I can't do the job sort of thing. But subsequent to this, he did do a bit of work in comics. He passed away, I think, in about 2015, I think I read somewhere, and at a fairly young age. But he was I think he had a fairly good run on Tarzan or something like that. Like he was a preeminent sort of Tarzan artist, I think I was reading. So it's sort of interesting, because it's having 20 episodes done by one artist in that short amount of time, it does give a continuity to the story that some stories where I know like early Dread stories where they would sort of mix up artists like through the thing and there'd be little sort of differences in characters and things like that. It just gave a good continuity to this whole sort of story.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, as you say, John Watkus did have a successful career in film and advertising, I believe, as well as doing quite a bit of comics work. Did some DC comics, I think. But yeah, Alan Davis, this is about the time when Alan Davis quits his day job and goes full-time as a comic book artist. As you say, Captain Britain, Marvel Man or Miracle Man, and then he was doing this. So in his introduction, he said, when they said, could you do the whole thing? And he said, yes. You know, he was doing massive amounts of pages at this time.
In
order to fill all these various deadlines. And he really, I think he learns on the job. You know, you might say that some of the early pages, his anatomy and so on is slightly off. But by the end of the 20 progs, he's become Alan Davis that we know and love, hasn't he?
Yeah. But even, like some of it, because there's lots of fighting sequences and things like that, like they're very well done. Like, you know, to be able to put that sort of level of action into some of these things, like, it sort of belies his so-called inexperience. But I really like it, and it's pure pen and ink sort of black and white sort of drawings, and it's just He gets the job done really well.
Like you say, he can really sell a punch, Alan Davis. The action figures or the action sequences with characters flying across the panel are always wonderful. Yeah. And these very lithe, athletic people twisting and turning and punching is great stuff. Now, also I read from his introduction here that as well as, you know, the two writers, there was a variety of space stuff which Alan Davis thought the writers hadn't really understood that he had to fix, about characters in spacesuits and characters climbing into modules and the idea of a Windows in the High Rock. He made a cardboard model of the High Rock itself to try and work out where everything was in the actual sort of, looks like a Dungeons and Dragon dice hanging in midair, doesn't it? Or hanging in space.
Yeah, no, it's not an extreme design, but it is a cool design, the High Rock. It's sort of, like you say, it's like a multifaceted sort of dice. I kind of find funny is they're gonna make this space capsule in the prison workshop and it's going to be sufficient to get them down to earth from researching it in the library sort of thing. So I think that's kind of funny, that sort of side of it.
Yeah. I mean, we can accept the three guys in Escape from Alcatraz building a raft out of Macintosh clothes. Yeah, raincoats.
Yeah,
building bits and pieces of a space capsule in the prison workshop and then transporting them outside the High Rock. Yeah, maybe, but fair enough. We accept
Old Ben 10 with his parachutes that he makes while he's working the laundry.
Yeah, exactly.
Ben 90.
So, well, let's talk about Ben 90. We're going to get to the big twist. I will ask you in a little while about the perfection of this 20-episode story. But before we do that, we're going to have a spoiler alert. We are going to discuss one of the biggest reveals in 2008 history, and I'll put the timings in the show notes for this episode so people can look there if they want to avoid the spoiler. Right, having said that, Glenn, tell us, what happens to Ben 90, and is this one of the big reveals in 2008 history?
Well, it is. It's probably the second biggest behind the dead man story. But yeah, Ben 90, who has been a much welcome source of knowledge for Harry, and knows the Rock back to front, turns out to be an android. And when they finally escape with him, yeah, all of a sudden they're on the ground. They think they're away, and then Ben peels his face back in classic Westworld fashion to reveal a robot face underneath. And so it's funny reading it, sort of knowing what the twist is going to be, to see if there was any little clues or things that they threw in there. But no, there was nothing really that they foreshadowed it. But yeah, it's sort of, I guess, like all good escape stories or all good stories in general, everything goes well until it absolutely turns pear-shaped. And in this case, yeah, they finally get off the Rock, and with all the issues they have getting out, other prisoners trying to get in on their escape and all that sort of thing. And then they hit the ground, and Ben's the ultimate traitor. He's been a setup since from the start. And it's very long range planning from Warden Worldwise, because you sort of wonder why they deemed Harry. They must have knew he was going to be a troublemaker, so they brought in the Ben 90 plan and put him in with those guys. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Or maybe a very long con from Warden Worldwise, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess the only other thing is we don't know in a population of 10,000 prisoners, and maybe there are other decks, so maybe there could be 10 Ben 90s running around with other potential escapees, I guess. But it's definitely a big twist, and that was the twist that was what ended the best of 2008 that I read. And even though it was only probably three episodes, and I didn't really know this story or this world to a degree, I could grasp it enough in those three episodes, and then have this big reveal, and it actually blew me away, wanting to know more about this story when I read it the first time, just in its own sort of little space. So yeah, it's definitely one of the greats. I guess without giving spoilers away, we've got our dead man. Our dead man twist back in the Dread universe. But what other twists other than the time twisters, obviously, which were sort of one-off sort of twist things? There wasn't that many sort of stories that I can think where there was these big twists. Was there? I'm not sure.
Well, the one that comes to my mind is a much more recent one, which is Dread kicking through the door in Trifecta into another.
Into another story. Yeah.
Yeah.
But even that's probably, would that be 10 years ago?
That's probably 10 years ago now, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the one I could think of. Yeah, this one is a big moment in 2000 AD. I suppose we've just done Zenith Book 3 and the reveal of the bad guy of that was a bit of a twist.
Oh, yeah, yep.
But nothing like Ben 90 peeling his face off and revealing that he's been a plant by Warden Worldwise the whole time and Harry 20 is not going to escape this time.
Yeah, and it was kind of, it was almost like it was just to torture Harry even more.
Yeah.
That, you know, we knew what you were doing the whole time and it was months of sort of work and planning and things like that. And, yeah, it's almost like a way of sort of demoralizing Harry and even, like, I think the other prisoners, that was the whole idea as well, was get Harry back up there and then they show a broken man to the other prisoners to say, well, there's no escape from the rock.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. Now, you have chosen nice sort of self-contained stories. Song of the Surfer, obviously part of the greater Chopper mythos, but it probably should have ended.
At the end of Song of the Surfer, yes.
Yeah. And then Fiends of the Eastern Front, another brilliantly sort of contained story, although, again, it's been the world has been expanded since then. What about Harry 20? Is it almost the perfect ideal of a 2000 AD thrill? 20 episodes, you got one artist throughout the whole lot. Is it nearly perfect as a self-contained story?
I think it is, yeah, because there's a lot of stuff that happens throughout it, and then we have like the ending of the story. It could have led to, well, what happens next? It does leave you to a degree because in the end the prisoners take over the High Rock and the government ends up blowing it out of orbit and it floats off into space and they've got enough food for 20 years. They ain't got dames, though. I don't know how. I don't think there's any women on the High Rock, so I'm not sure if I'd want to be on a floating ex-prison just with 9,000 odd other men and criminals at that. So I'm not sure how that would go, but yeah, it definitely it's a bit different for comics of that time because I think the whole idea for a lot of these comics was you keep sort of, you know, banging out stories and things like that. And, you know, sometimes it's done very successfully and sometimes it's not done that successfully. But, you know, the really popular characters of the time, like obviously Dredd had already been going for 4 or 5 years, but Rogue Trooper, you know, he come along sort of in that sort of year and he lasts a long time and many, many episodes. So yeah, it's a sort of interesting thing to have, yeah, just this one-off sort of story where it sort of ends and we don't see anything of it again by Jerry or anyone in his sort of group of writers around that time. No one sort of picked up the baton sort of thing. So yeah.
He did, of course, yes. I mean, I think it is that, as I say, that wonderful thing, a self-contained story. There, as you mentioned earlier on, Glenn, there was a sort of brief cameo for Harry 20, again, about 10 years ago, in a free Comic Book Day edition of 2000 AD. Did you read Death Rock when that one came out?
I did, actually, yeah. I sort of, until I was re-looking at this, I'd sort of forgotten about it, so it obviously didn't have that much of an effect from the thing, but I do remember reading it, and then, yeah, it's included in the Hachette edition.
Oh, is it? Right.
So, yeah, which was cool because when I first was looking at it, I was like, oh, man, I'm going to have to try and dig out my Prog 2015, free Prog 2015. I don't know where it is. But then, yeah, it was in there. But, yeah, I think I guess it was a cool sort of thing in that, you know, it's like, oh, wow, they did end up somewhere on this sort of planet. But, yeah, it was sort of left up in the air. I think reading about, I think it was in this where they're talking about that at the time that that entire issue of the free comic book was going to be picking up loose threads like this and just having one-off sort of continuations or you know, this is what happened. And then I don't think that sort of end up being what that free prog was. So it was sort of just one of the stories where they said, oh, this is Harry 20 now sort of thing. But yeah, it hasn't been sort of picked up or taken on board so far. And I guess there would have been stories to tell, but yeah, it's never been sort of expanded on.
That Death Rock strip was drawn by Ben Wilshire, written by somebody called Barry Krishna, which has got to be a pseudonym, well, I'm guessing.
I think that's a pseudonym for Keith Richardson.
Ah, it would
the graphic novels editor for Rebellion. I'm pretty sure that they say that in this book sort of thing.
And
it sort of makes sense because he's a guy that I've heard quite a bit where he definitely enjoys that sort of period of 2000 AD and talking about it and finding those old sort of stories and strips and getting them republished sort of thing. So it makes sense that he was the one who saw Harry 20 as an opportunity to go, well, I wonder what happened to that guy. And yeah, it was his version of a twist ending, I guess, where it's a guy landing on a jungle sort of planet and meeting a person, and then yeah, the last page is where Harry 20 appears and the High Rock in the background.
I was going to mention a film connection. We were trying to make a three-way recording with Conrad work, and I couldn't get the timings to fit. But next week, hopefully, all being well, I will be back talking to Conrad about a film called Lockout. If you're thinking of a prison floating in space, there's obviously Harry 20 in the High Rock, but you may also think of the Guy Pearce Lockout movie, which is coming up on the Film Club. Have you seen that at all, Glenn?
I had never heard of it, to be honest, and being a good Australian, no, I do like Guy Pearce. He's been in some really good sort of genre pictures and that. So until you mentioned it, I'd never heard of it, and I tracked it down, and I started watching it, and I didn't get it finished, sort of thing. Not for lack of entertainment, because it's a good sort of. Yeah, prison in space movie, but yeah, I'm about two-thirds the way through it, and but yeah, it's got Luc Besson, the French director, who did he do like The Fifth Element and different
he
things
did,
like
yes.
that. So it's got a fairly good pedigree there, even though I think on Rotten Tomatoes, when I sort of did a bit of research about it, it was sort of poo-pooed a little bit. But from what I'd seen, I kind of enjoyed the sort of thing, and I could see why you'd sort of think of it when you think a bit about the High Rock, even though it was a much more nicely designed prison than the High Rock simplicity. But yeah. I was sort of also thinking about those other sort of classic prison escape movies. You mentioned Escape from Alcatraz, and I think in this volume they sort of said it may have been the little bit of an inspiration for Jerry in this one, like the prison break, but then twisting it, doing the Jerry twist and setting it in space. But then I was also thinking of Papillon as another great prison film, escape film, and then Shawshank Redemption, you know, from the Stephen King story as well, as another sort of very, it's a down to earth prison break, but it's another great sort of lots of villainous sort of wardens and things like that, and then one man taking a long time to get out. So it is a sort of a genre of film that I must admit, yeah, I do enjoy that sort of thing, and so
yeah, great prison break films. Alan Davis's sketches for Harry Thompson based him a little bit on Harrison Ford's look in Blade Runner, but also Steve McQueen from Papillon would also make a good Harry 20 as well, wouldn't he?
Yeah. No, that's a great film. Anyway, if anyone hasn't seen Papillon, like it's kind of bleak, but it's very, very good. And Dustin Hoffman as well is great in it. Like his character, I forget what his name is, but yeah, the way he sort of the craziness that he sort of exhibits over time in that movie is amazing as well. So yeah.
Okay, well, stay tuned to this channel for the Mega City Film Club when we will discuss gravelly voice action hero Guy Pearce in some wildly entertaining trash in Lockout.
He is very gravelly voiced, and that's what he's not his usual sort of voice. He's very, doing his best sort of deep sort of mysterious voice in it, Guy. But yeah. No, it's nicely trashy.
I think it was from that period when all the Hollywood actors were getting their sort of like revenge action gravelly voice movie after Taken.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it's a bit of a Statham like voice as well.
It's a bit Statham. It's a bit of a Statham film, actually. Yeah. Okay, well, Lockout hopefully will be coming up next week. But let's go back to Harry 20 on the High Rock by Jerry Finlay Day and Alan Davis. Let's give you all of this wonderful black and white art by Alan Davis, which we probably cannot afford, but we'll play virtually. There's also three prog covers also by Alan Davis. He's done the whole kit and caboodle. What are going to be your Grail pages, Glenn?
Well, once again, when I think of Grail pages and things like this, does anyone have this Alan Davis art? Who's got it? Because I think Alan Davis, like his particularly his 2000 AD art, I don't think there's much of that really out there, is there? Like his Quinch stuff, and he did a few Dreads and things like that. But I'm sort of wondering if there's a vault whether Alan's got some of it or it's in a vault. Grail pages. Well, as far as the covers go, the cover of Prog 302, which is Ben 90's robot face. I assume it was the week after the big reveal. It's a really nice image. That would be like my cover grail. And then flicking through the issues, I think it's the final page of episode 2, so it's fairly early on in it. We're looking back from space to the little portal window, and we've got the heavenly bodies, which is all the dead prisoners that are thrown out into the vacuum of space, and they're now become little satellites around the High Rock to remind everybody that, you know, there's no escape from the High Rock, and that's what you're going to get. So yeah, that's probably the grail page, because we've got Harry and Genghis and Ben all in there, but we've also got this really nice sort of dark picture of these frozen bodies in space, which I really liked. So that's probably my prog page. Like it's I love the art throughout. There's nothing outside of the obvious. You know, the big reveal would be another one, but yeah, it's kind of there's a lot to like about the artwork, but it's hard to pick a grail page because it's just so consistently good.
Yeah, I mean that page from the end of episode 2, I notice. I mean, again, I'm going a lot from what Alan Davis says in his introduction. Steve McManus thought that Alan was a little bit too American comics and wanted to make his artwork grittier, and this is a real gritty page. Actually, there's a lot of dark.
I'd read that. Yeah, I thought it was quite interesting. I thought, like, he definitely has an American style in the sort of vein of like your Dave Gibbons and Brian Bolland. You can see they obviously enjoyed their American comics as an inspiration sort of thing, but. Yeah, I thought, that the artwork is not as – it is gritty. Like, it's not as clean as, like, a Bolland sort of thing, the way he sort of did his sort of line work, or even there was a grittiness throughout the story of, you know, backgrounds and things like that, and characters looking disheveled as they go through, like their uniforms get more and more disheveled. So I'm sort of surprised that McManus thought it was too clean, sort of thing.
Yeah, because this is a grim and gritty page. Their uniforms are torn, they look battered and bruised. And then, of course, as you say, the terrible warning to the prisoners of the heavenly bodies which just float in space outside the High Rock, which is it's quite terrifying and beautifully depicted by Alan Davis with that shot looking back at Harry looking out of the window. It's amazing.
I think it's actually is it commented on in the story as to that's why the windows are there in the High Rock. So all you can do is look out at Earth and look at in between the heavenly bodies sort of thing and realize, okay, we're not getting out of here sort of thing. I think it's quite a if you think of who would have been reading the prog back then, like their target would have been, you know, juvenile boys sort of thing. And yeah, as a sort of eight to 12 year old kid seeing like, yeah, dead bodies in space and things like that would have been pretty cool, I would have thought.
Yeah. You'd also mentioned before we started recording, there's the Squark page as well, isn't there, when they...
I'm just flicked through to it now, yeah, because that was actually something I could remember in the Best of 2000 AD, where they're floating around in their pod, they've escaped the High Rock, and, yeah, Ben's fishing, and then we've got a Squark, which is a combination shark octopus, and it sort of Ben almost gets him into trouble there as it sort of tentacles are trying to get into the pub and drag him out and things like that. And there's a nice page with the Squark on the bottom left-hand corner, and it's, well, it's a flaming Squark, Harry yelling out. So that's a nice sort of page as well.
Amazing.
With the boys in trouble.
So you've got the cover to Prog 302, you've got two internal pages by Alan Davis. I will post all these pages when this episode comes out next week. I'm just going to turn you very quickly to the first page of episode 6, which I'll hold up to the camera for you now. This is a title page. I wanted one of the title pages with a view of the High Rock. I love the 3D Harry 20 on the High Rock logo for the strip, which I'm going to guess might be a Robin Smith design, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, definitely. I was thinking of a title page similar to you because of that great logo, and you have the High Rock depicted in generally in that first panel. They would have the High Rock depicted like that, and yeah, it's definitely a great logo. Like it's kind of, it's great in its simplicity. It's just
Beautiful design.
High Rock and then Harry 20 on the side. Yeah, no, it's definitely great. Yeah, I've found that one there. Yep.
And then at the bottom of the page, you've got Harry 20.
Hands off Toady.
That's it. Throwing the tape canister at Toady. And you've got this beautiful athletic moment from Alan Davis, where once again showing characters in motion, which is always brilliant. So that's my grail page from Harry 20 on the High Rock.
Definitely a cracker, and you've got a nice big red one in there as well on the top of that one, so you get to see him as well, because he's definitely a fairly well designed character as well. Like he's just a giant man, and he's got like the big scar across his face, and yeah, you wouldn't want to run into him in a dark alley.
No. I notice in the sketches at the back of my volume that he's described in the notes next to the sketch as like a giant ginger cousin of Massimo Ballardinelli.
Oh, that's great. Hence the big beard, I guess.
Yeah. Right. Well, that was Harry 20 on the High Rock. We have said it is available digitally from the 2000 AD store for $7.99. It's also, I think, in the Best of Gerry Finley Day collection. You've got it in the Hachette Ultimate Collection, which is issue 168, and it was volume, what was the spine number?
Volume 160.
Yeah.
It's also in the Best of 2000 AD, number 28, the original Best of 2000 AD. And it got reprinted. I found this off the old, I don't know whether it's still updated, but the ever reliable Barney site. It was actually reprinted in Judge Shred magazine 209 to 213, and then 2000 AD presents number 8 to 15 by Quality Comics. So yeah, it definitely had been reprinted quite a bit. So it was definitely seen as like something that they thought would interest new readers along the way, I guess, that it was a good sort of story.
Well, what I'll do is I'll post in the show notes for this episode a link to that Barney page, so you can see all the different ways to collect or find Harry 20 on the High Rock.
Is Barney still being managed by someone, do you know? Or
I don't think it's been currently updated, no, unfortunately, that's my understanding. Yeah. I think the guy who was doing it has been, unfortunately, too busy with other stuff to make
more recent. Okay, it's a great page. If you're ever looking for something 2000 AD related, particularly, like characters and artists and things like that, it's very thorough. They've got all the covers there that you can see and then synopsis of what's in each prog and different comics and things. So, yeah, it's very good.
Excellent stuff. Well, Harry 20 on the High Rock is an absolute banger. You can also find out more about it if you listen to Space Spinner 2000 collection number 29, I believe. You'll find their collection of their review of Harry 20. It is just this beautiful self-contained story from the early golden age of 2000 AD. Thank you for picking it, Glenn.
No worries. Just before we finish, I thought we hadn't mentioned the gravy train.
Yes.
Which is the punishment detail, where that's how they get access to outside the High Rock. And there's ice builds up on the High Rock from the vents, from the sort of waste and the laundry. And then when I think about gravy, you can only imagine there must be raw sewage, I assume. That might be why it's called the gravy train. So yeah, I just thought I'd bring that up as well before we sign off. I sort of wondered whether that might have been an Alan Grant sort of a name for the punishment detail, the gravy train. I just thought that might have been his little input there, perhaps, or maybe Jerry did think of that. But yeah, that made me sort of laugh when I sort of thought about it in retrospect. Yeah. That the gravy train being all the waste.
I mean, it's full of great moments, despite some of the improbabilities of a prison in space. But it is full of these great moments with them in and outside the High Rock itself.
It's very. There's lots of tropes there, but it's very well. Like it doesn't outstay its welcome, and it's just good fun sort of. Classic sort of that sort of tale from that time, so definitely highly recommend it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, double thumbs up from us here on the Book Club. Glenn, thank you so much for picking it. Thanks for giving up your time this Sunday. Sorry that we got the time zones wrong, but that's on me.
Okay. That's the world we live in, where we can actually do this. It's great. The time differences can be easily sort of overlooked or we had our change in time a couple of weeks ago with daylight saving, so that's all good.
Thank you very much, Clem.
No worries.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. Find all of these links at megacitybookclub.com. Look at the Grail pages posted on Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, Facebook, Substack, Mastodon, and the 2000 AD forums. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you'd like to come on the show. So until next time that we report back from a prison floating in the depths of space, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from me.